Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Gardner, the host of Office Hours with John Gardner. As a faculty member, my office hour practice was always where I had my most important conversations with my students and occasionally my faculty and staff colleagues. So I look forward to each one, and definitely that's the case today. It's a pleasure for me to introduce a friend and a colleague of mine for more decades than she would want me to admit to you publicly. And so it's a pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Susan Wheeler Johnson, who I'm going to let her tell you what she, I'll talk about it kind of general terms, but Dr. Johnson has achieved many firsts. And if she doesn't mention them, I'm going to tell you all. But she is the chief executive officer of an organization that serves thousands of chief financial officers and their staff in helping manage American higher education. She is also a recovering former English professor, okay? And that has stayed with her in everything we know about her. And she's also an expert on working with the men and women who govern America's 4,000 post-secondary institutions, namely college and university trustees. And she's just a really fine humanist in her own right. And I thought she would have some perspectives on innovation in higher education from the vantage point of a person who's done those kinds of things. We want her to tell her story. So the first thing I'm going to ask her, if she would recount in a manner that she would choose, and I will not direct, at least initially, her journey. What were some of the key markers in that journey? Because we're all on a journey where we could become even more impactful as innovators. And so we want to get in touch with Susan's journey. So Susan, just start anywhere you want and tell us whatever you'd like to tell us about that journey.
Thank you, John. And thank you for letting me join you on your office hours. I do remember office hours as a wonderful time in which I could reflect on the work I was doing and talk to students about how they were understanding it. So this is a great idea that you have here. Thank you for that. You mentioned some of the work that I've done, and I'll be honest that one of the ways in which you get all that experience is to live a while and work a while. So I did begin my career as an English professor at a small liberal arts college in Illinois. And to be perfectly honest, that is where I thought I would start and end my career. I did do that work for about 20 years. But then I was interested in what was beyond the single individual institution. And so I began to look for other career opportunities, I guess I'll say, and looked at going to another institution, but found instead the world of higher education associations, which is fascinating in itself. But I found a role at the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities, AGB. And I thought, well, I'll stay there for maybe 2 years. And about 18 years later, I decided it might be time to move on. And so I found the position that I currently hold, which is president and CEO of NACUBO, the National Association of College and University Business Officers. So those are the facts. But I want to tell you what I think is at the heart of this. I think a big part of my upbringing is important in how, or my early education is important in how I've gotten where I am today. I had wonderful role models when I was in high school. I had wonderful women teachers. And this was at a time when really smart women didn't go to med school or to law school. They just weren't admitted. And they often ended up in the great public school systems, particularly around me. So I had these wonderfully smart women who said to me, it's okay to be smart. It's good to be smart. Why don't you just go ahead and be smart? I also had two brothers, very athletic, and I engaged in a lot of sports when I was coming up. And so I learned that being assertive is good, and sometimes being aggressive is right if your purpose is a good one. I learned to want to win, whatever that looks like in the context in which you're playing. And I took those with me throughout my professional life, the idea of women as leaders and being aggressive for the right things. Those were both parts of what I've found to be useful and important as I've advanced through my career. I'll tell you, when I was hired in an English department of all places, there were no other women. I remember asking somebody, where's the bathroom? Where's the ladies' restroom? Because I couldn't see where the women were. But finally, we got a little better at that. And there were many more women joining the faculty. But just those two points about women in leadership roles and learning to be assertive and even aggressive for the right purposes were very important to me.
You've given me just a great door that I'm going to drive my truck through here. This phrase you've used twice, being aggressive for the right thing. Please give us immediately a couple of examples in your life where you've decided to take a stand to be aggressive for the right thing.
Well, you know, off the top of my head, one of them is a project that we are working on right now at Nakubo. Now, Nakubo is, as I said, it's the Association for College and University Business Officers. And our members are of all sorts, large, small, research, community college, all over the country. But I come not with that background. I come with the background of education, student support, teaching. I'm very much a faculty member at heart. And that's different for Nakubo. One of the things that I think is really important is for chief business officers and others to understand that the work that they do is in support of student success. We have endowments, not just to have a lot of money to invest, but in order to provide support for students for decades and maybe centuries to come. We have buildings, not just to have the latest and greatest architecture, and campuses, not just to have the most beautiful campus, but to serve students and their needs today, tomorrow, into the future. So I think that one of the things I've helped happen with Nakubo is to put before the business officers the belief that we need to be all in on student success. Equity. This is important for our individual institutions, but it's important for our nation, and it's important for the individual students that we deal with. From my very first opportunity to speak to our members, I talked to them about their role in helping to provide opportunity, which I think is at the core work of what higher education does, and the business officers have to see that as their role. It's easy to get caught up in what is an overwhelming job of managing institutional finances, physical plants, safety and security on campus, all the things that a business officer is charged with. But if they lose sight of students, equity, inclusion, success, then they aren't working in higher education. They're doing something else. That's one of the things I feel I've been pretty aggressive about at Nakubo. And I think maybe at AGB, the aggressiveness came in leading a project on shared governance, something I also believe in. And when you work with governing boards, it's a mysterious topic that they don't understand and wish that they could work without. But we've done, we did a pretty good job, I think, of making it clear that, aggressively making it clear that it was important for boards to understand how to work best with the various constituents, including faculty. So those are two examples of being aggressive for the right purpose.
Thank you. And I appreciate your explicitness about those. And I'm reminded that when I was a faculty member, a young faculty member, I got lured into a departmental level administration. And it was several senior officers in my university's business staff that taught me an enormous amount. And they understood what really mattered. They understood that our work was about making students successful. And they understood better than many, of course, the financial implications of this, and also the meaning of it for the larger society and the state that we serve. So I feel like I have a real indebted. I could name these. Most of them were men. I could name them today. They are really with me, a part of me. So at what point your identity as an evolving adult person, at what point did you realize that you had some kind of agency to affect change in ways that might be innovative? I can think of one example. I don't want to answer your question, but I'll give an example that I know about you after your response to that question. You know, when did your insight, your self-awareness, when did this come upon you that you could do more of this intentionally?
Probably as I became a faculty member and got a little more experience under my belt, I began to see that, if you had a good idea, that wasn't enough, that you had to be able to make a case for it. And you had to be able to get into an argument and do it well and end friends, but you had to be able to stand up. And again, I worked in a very male-dominated, which wasn't unusual at the time, male-dominated institution, at all leadership levels. And I had to decide that I could do this and I could make an argument and defend it and stick with it and not say, oh, okay, and kind of slink away. It was a hard thing to do. It was not the culture I was brought up in, but I think that's when it started. And, you know, maybe you might be thinking of when I was a faculty member and decided that it was time for us to follow some of the teachings of this guy named John Gardner, who said that we had to pay attention to these freshmen. And the first year experience was a really important one. I learned a lot from going to meetings that you organized, and wanted to take some of that back to my college and make sure that we were taking advantage of good experience from others. You know, one of the things I have a question about with innovation is innovation something that's never been done, or is it something that just hasn't been done here? Because I think that you can be innovative at your institution by studying what's going on around you and making sure that whatever you think would benefit your institution finds fertile ground and advocates back at home, and making a plan for how to make that happen. So my idea of innovation is, if you make it work in your own place, that's innovation. If you make it work and sustain itself, that's innovation.
You're very close to what I was recalling. I was recalling that you encouraged me to create a special strand of meetings for Midwestern small colleges that I hadn't done before. And you saw that your institution might be more likely to want to gain from that if they were a part of it, if they took some ownership for the sponsorship of it. And I thought that was very wise on your part. It was clever, but not in any kind of devious sense. It was positively clever because it did increase their ownership, and it was a very unselfish. I saw you concluding that if others benefited, you would benefit, you and your college.
That's right.
Yeah, you said that a person, in your case, this was you, that you have to argue well and be able to stand up. Right now, as divided as our society is, I'm finding that people don't know how to argue well without really alienating those they do need to get to embrace their cause. Will you, for those of you who are listening to this, and I mean, what does she mean by argue well? The very word, the verb argue, has multiple connotations. So, you know, when I think of Susan Johnston, a person who is remarkably skilled at arguing well. So would you please elaborate on that?
You know, probably from nearly 20 years, no, more than 20 years of teaching composition and rhetoric, what I mean is what we taught students, which is to, you know, figure out, well, what's the thesis? What's your driving point? What are you trying to get others to believe? And then how would you construct that to acknowledge where your audience or your listener may stand on the point, present the details of your idea as persuasively as possible. If you're talking to business officers, you want to mention cost, but you might also mention savings, and you might also mention mission. So understanding who the audience is and what might drive them. John, you mentioned today's climate, and I think that we don't acknowledge what other people believe, and we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. And so I think that part of arguing well is really acknowledging that we are not individually the owners of the truth, and that other people have a stake in the truth. They have a perspective. They need to be listened to. I think in the case of arguing well for innovation, that comes with its own challenges. Innovation is scary for a lot of people because change is scary. I had a friend I worked with for a long time who used to quote alternately Mark Twain and, you know, other people. But the point was, he would say, I'm all for progress. It's just change I don't like. So the idea that innovation is going to require some change, and that people are generally uncomfortable with change because it means disruption. It means perhaps putting something that they're very fond of on a back burner, or maybe putting it to rest. So arguing well means taking all of that into account, but also being able to, I think, excite people with a new idea. What's in it for them? But also, is there a really big goal that this new thing can help us accomplish. And, you know, in my case, a lot of what excites me today is innovation that is supportive of equity and student success. So that's where I kind of land when I think about arguing well, understanding the audience, what motivates them, understanding their fears, presenting your case clearly with examples, but finding something that sparks that hope or vision for the future, or being better than we are now. If you can get people excited, they will join in with your innovation and even make it better than what you thought it could be.
I've heard you do something. I'll give a very concrete example of how you argue well. You mentioned that if you're dealing with, as you are, with business people, you need to look at costs and savings, et cetera. What I've heard you do is you not only look at the costs, you look at the costs of not doing something. You know, you're able to introduce various perspectives on how to measure cost. And I guess, Susan, it would be true or accurate to describe you as the first a former faculty member who's ever led this organization, as well as the first woman who's ever led this organization. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you said that about innovation, you gave us two, I thought, wonderful differentiations. One version of innovation is something that's never been done, period, versus something that just hasn't been done here. So if you look either at your former role working with university trustees, college trustees, or now with business officers, would you give us an example of something that, you know, you've seen that you think is innovative, but just hasn't been done here?
Well, at AGB, we created an online learning center for board members. You know, you got learning centers all over the place on our campuses.
Right.
But I thought we needed it for board members.
You made AGB more like a campus.
A little bit, mm-hmm. This was online only. And because we knew that board members, a lot of us, and I am a board member, as you are,
yes.
You know, we've got day jobs and we can't go to the learning center during the daytime and call up a person who's going to be there. So we needed 24 hour a day, 7 day a week access to governance information. And so that's what we did. It had certainly been done in a lot of places, but it hadn't been done with AGB, and we had to tailor it to board members instead of to students.
Great example. That's very concrete. I'm sure listeners will appreciate that indeed. So here you are. You're the CEO and president. You are such a realist. You know you can't do everything that needs to be done, innovative or otherwise. So you have to have others in your organization also becoming more innovative. So how, as the leader of this organization, how do you create the conditions where others innovate? I know I think about this in my own small organization that I founded. If I'm the only innovator there, we don't have a future. We really don't. We got to empower every single member of the organization, no matter what they do, I believe. How do you do that, Susan?
Well, one of the things that I've done is put together a leadership group that I think rivals anybody's leadership group. I like to say that together we're a complete brain. And by that, I mean that I've just got a diversity of thinking, diversity of skills, diversity of experience. And I know that this vice president is going to argue against every idea because that's the way she thinks. She wants to punch holes in things and see if it can bear up, if the new idea can bear up. I have another who gets very practical. Well, how would we make that happen? And I have others that bring other ways of thinking and other skill sets. So I think that's a big part of it. I have tried to be clear that failure is okay. It's not our goal. You know, we're not designed to fail, but and it's not our purpose, but it's okay if you're failing on the way to creating something new. I had one person on staff who was very excited about an idea, but didn't have a clue how to implement it. And I just said, you know, pick a direction, see if it works. If you fail, I got your back. We're fine. You're not going to kill us. But if you succeed, that's going to be a really great new addition to what we do. So it's okay to fail. I want people to see me as innovative and therefore spark a little innovation in them. And to be honest, I say both to the board and to the staff, all ideas are welcome. Don't filter, just bring it. And we'll talk about it. And it may be that we keep only 5% of the ideas that come forward. But what a contribution. Yeah. 5% new ideas. That's great.
Yeah, I often say for every 10 ideas I've got, 9 of them are losers, but there's one gem there. And you got to be able to do something with that one. I want to ask you, this is a difficult question for me. It's one I grapple with all the time, and you may not want to, you know, deal with it. Well, I know you have to deal with it, but I don't know. Well, let me just tell you what it is. You and I have in common that we are both privileged white members of the Academy. Mm-hmm. We have positions of power and influence, and we know that there are fellow colleagues of ours in American higher education who see that as a limit, our racial and ethnic identity. Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with that, Susan? I know how I'm dealing with it. I'm struggling with it, but I think it's real. It's the elephant in the room. You know, there's nothing there are some things I can do about this, but I can't change my skin color, my ethnicity, my childhood. So then the question is, well, what can I do? So I don't want to answer the question, but how are you cognizant of that and acting in terms of that? You told us twice in this relatively brief podcast, you've told us that the most important thing you're focusing on in terms of your big picture values, what you want for the organization and the country, has to do with equity. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's a big topic for conversation at Nakubo, and in two ways. One is for us as an organization, the people I work with on a daily basis, but it's also important for us to help our members understand the value of looking for and supporting diversity of all kinds in their workplace. So I start with Nakubo as an organization. And I'll just tell you what happened that brought the topic up for us. I joined Nakubo, which I have always, as an outsider, I always thought it was an extremely diverse organization. As a model, I thought, given the higher education associations, Nakubo is extremely diverse in all kinds of ways. And I got there. That was true. But I'd been there for about 3 months, and I lost 3 really good African-American women right away. And I thought, I wonder if I have have a really big problem here. And I wonder if I have caused that problem in some way. And I pulled in some of the diverse leaders that we have at Nakubo and just said, talk to me about this. How should I see it? Have I done something? Is there something that I haven't done that I need to do? And they were difficult conversations. I was new and I was asking people to be honest with, you know, their boss that they didn't really know that well yet. But it was very helpful. We had an all staff meeting and I talked about it. And afterwards, people said, you know, thank you for opening that door for us to talk. The thing that we did next was form a group, a committee on diversity, equity, and inclusion that I tasked with doing several things. One was to bring forward suggestions for improving how we work at Nakubo. But I also wanted a statement on diversity, equity, and inclusion for us. And I wanted it to be very thorough. And by that, I mean, not just that the staff buys in, but the board buys in and actually approves it. So we did that and we've released it to our members. We've talked about it with our members. And we've done other intentional projects to make sure that, again, going both inside the organization and outside, making sure that people see us as committed to what is a very important conversation and set of actions. And we are not the best resource on this topic. It's a topic that many people are expert on, but that our members can turn to Nakubo to at least start the conversation for themselves in their own offices. Now, I may have rambled well beyond what you had in mind, John, but you gave me a question that reminded me of some early decisions I had to make.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At Nakubo.
Well, I think you're, I'm not judging your answer, but it's very personal, very specific. It's meaningful. I suspect that a number of listeners have their own organizations where they have to be dealing with this and are asking themselves, how are they dealing with it? Are they trying to avoid it, or are they not seeing things they should? And if they're not, how could they see those? And you just gave an example of how you went about that. Yeah. You know, as my wife wisely and kindly reminds me, if you can't stand the answer, don't ask the question. And, you know, you took a lot of risk here early in your, you know, your new role in doing that. And when you look around at our enterprise, higher education, you've taught in it. You're on an institution, your campus for 20 or so years, and you work with an organization that has 40,000 trustees. It's 100 years old, lots of traditions. Now you're working with even more business officers and everything, but all those that fall into that rubric. And so all of this is in the context of what you see are the things that matter most in American higher education, where innovation is needed. So when you look out at the academy that you serve and I serve, what do you think are the touch points in the academy for our students that are most in need of innovation right now? Okay. And, you know, if they're that obvious and that pervasive, surely there's a connection of them to what business officers do. And so what would be your, you know, you want to have top five, a group of us, including several of your good friends, Betsy Barefoot and Leo Lambert, we and Peter Felt, and Charles Schroeder, we did a book a few years ago called The Undergraduate Experience, What Matters Most. We came up with we had to force ourselves to decide what matters most. Where should we be concentrating our energies? And you can't do everything. Nakubo can't do everything. So I'm sure you got to make sure the organization's focused. So again, the question, what do you think most needs innovation And how could we connect business officers to that?
John, you ask such good questions.
I'm a liberal arts product, a small liberal arts college like you worked at.
You know, one of the things I think that we need to have a conversation about, but conversation isn't action. We need action on is how education is structured and delivered. You know, people like me are quite comfortable with classes that are 3 days a week for an hour, meet in person, have the weekend off, and on, the usual traditional look at higher education and how we learn. But that model, I know it's changing, but I'm not sure it's changing fast enough to accommodate the different ways in which people learn and the different lives that people live today. So I think that's one thing, you know, what does a class look like in the 21st century? I think another thing that is maybe tied to that, but maybe it's larger, is how do we use our resources? And by that, I largely mean dollars, but not entirely. People are resources. Physical plant is a resource. So how do we use our resources to accomplish the goal of equitable opportunity and student success? And this is maybe out there, but, you know, I don't think that you have to have the most beautiful campus in the world. I don't think you have to have the largest, most winning football team in the country. I know, heresy, but we spend a lot of resources on things that surround the student experience, but not all students take advantage of them. Not all students want them. Not all students think they're important. And after a while, they add to the cost of education. I don't believe these things reduce the cost of education. So, you know, I think focusing how we use our resources and make sure that they are targeted toward the outcomes and not toward the vision that we might have for an institution, but rather students within the institution. I'm not sure I'm going to give you five, John.
Okay, you don't have to. You don't have to. I have one very specific practical question about Kubo. Nobody ever suggested to me when I was trying to learn how to become an academic administrator, as well as a faculty member, John, you ought to get interested in the Kubo. Nobody ever said that to me.
Well, John, it's not too late. You should get interested in the Kubo.
Okay, so tell me, who are you? Who are the members? Who is your organization trying to embrace?
We have about 45,000 members, and they are all of the people who serve in the business and finance offices and who report up to the business and finance offices of colleges and universities. We have about 1,800 institutional members, but business and finance offices and those who report to them, that's a lot of people. So that's our primary audience. But, you know, maybe again, an overblown idea, but I think we should be talking to presidents, to board members, to the cabinets, and to faculty.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what about people, not so much about academic people, whose work now is so inextricable from the work of the people you just named. Do you have any, any ways to reach out to the academic side of the house?
It's hard. We have done programming for chief business officers and chief academic officers to come together.
Yeah, great.
Marriage counseling, maybe.
It's better than divorce, I guess.
Right. So we've done some of that. What I think would be really helpful to colleges and universities is for us to find a way to help faculty and maybe early administrators understand the basics of higher education finance. So that I'm going to come back to your idea of innovation, so that when innovation is necessary, when people have a good idea, they understand the business context within which it can occur. A good idea on its own is a good idea, but it's got to lead to something, some action, some outcome. And most of these don't occur absent some financial framework. So I do think that having a good understanding of higher education finance in general, but then the institution's business model and how it functions financially would be a really helpful thing to add to faculty members' general education.
I want to recommend, you may feel this is extreme, but in my case, I can remember these three people vividly. I had three members of the staff of the business office at the University of South Carolina, including the chief business officer, the three of them who adopted me. They saw me as a young, promising person that they needed to educate. They took it upon themselves to mentor me. And I had no idea when I went into this work what was done on the administrative side of a major university. I was a faculty member. And oh, did I learn a lot from those three guys. And I will forever be indebted to them. And I would recommend to any aspiring or even someone who's already achieved, they think, in administration, that they get some mentoring from people in the profession now that you lead. I mean it. This podcast is not about me. It's about you.
But I think you're right. I think you're right. And I think that if I could just summarize that point, often we, and I mean myself as a former faculty member, look at the office of the chief financial officer as the office of no.
Yes.
That what we have to do is look at it as the office of how. How can we make that happen? How can we take that good idea and scale it up and roll it out? More conversation across the divide there between faculty and administration, in particular the business office, is a great idea.
Well, I'd like to add one word in addition to not only changing no to how, but also why. These men and women need to help the rest of us understand some options for why. That if we don't have the rationale, we can't, as you said, argue persuasively. And I've had to go up with some senior business officers that I didn't have the argument down nearly as well as they did. And that's something we could learn from them. Mm-hmm. You've obviously got all kinds of things that I know you want to do, and you've got a lot of time to do it. And, as a person who stayed 18 years in her last position, you're different from me. I could never get another job. I spent 32 years at one place. But you've shown you could get another job. But one of my hopes for you is, not that this really matters, but that you stay with us. And as you know, innovation takes a long time.
Yeah.
And, how old is Nakubo?
60.
60.
Just this year, 60.
Okay. Now, that's a very lot of traditions there. Mm-hmm. And Susan, if anybody wanted to follow up with you, I can tell them that you are approachable. How would they do that?
I would be happy to follow up with anybody. My email address is pretty straightforward. It's S as in Susan, S Johnston with a T in it, Johnston, at nacubo.org. That's the best way to get me.
N-A-C-U-B-O, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think you've shown the way here. I know because I live with a woman, my wife, who was also educated in elementary, middle, and high school by the kind of women you describe, women for whom there were not other alternatives, but they were outstanding teachers and showed the way for an entire generation. And you've shown the way. And what you're really doing here, I think, is quite precedent setting. That most faculty think about business officers as innovators. They do think of them as cost cutters and people who have arguments for why we can't do such and such. So you've really, I'm sure, enhanced the perspectives of a number of our listeners. I really appreciate, Susan, your good faith response to my questions. I hope they were clearly manageable. No tough challenge for you.
Thank you, John. Thanks for sharing your office hour with me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I want to have others with you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us today. This is Susan Johnston with a T at nacubo.org. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute, and we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.